Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, thank you.
We thank you very sweetly.
Thanks a lot.
It's National Thank You Day, Thanksgiving, and we're together. Isn't that great? We're kind of like family, actually a real improvement. I mean, if I annoy you, you can just turn me off. No, thank you. So you're traveling. Are you prepping a meal? Are you dodging the whole business of Thanksgiving altogether, doing some public community service project, mashing potatoes for a good cause? Why, thank you. Thank you. We can never thank you enough.
Came to say thank you.
Thank you from the depth of my heart.
I want to thank you.
But enough thank yous. What have we got for you this hour? Only some favorite takeaway moments from the year. The stories that caused you to reach out to us. And thank you very much for that, by the way. You love Neil deGrasse Tyson. How about his mom, Toni? Let's just call her the mother of Mr. Cosmos. The mother of all those crazy ties Neil wears. We got Toni.
Thank you to everyone.
Thanks, you guys.
And settle down. There's more. Did you see the movie Boyhood? If not, did you hear about that great moment in the film where actor Ethan Hawke assembles an album, an Uber playlist of tunes by Beatles artists post-breakup? Not the White Album, the Black Album. Get it? It's a conversation with Soundcheck's John Schaefer, who knows his Beatles and probably has a full collection of albums from Apple Records. That was the Beatles label, right? Apple Records. How about a conversation with a man who knows more about the species of real apples than just about anyone? I know. No one is thanking me for that apple-to-apple segue. Kind of like putting lipstick on a pig. But we will be talking about red lipstick, its history, and why even after a hard day in the kitchen, putting on red lipstick can change the mood for the better around any Thanksgiving table. Why I might even give it a try this year. But enough of this intro from me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to say thank you to you.
Yeah. All this hour, we'll be asking you, what's the best thank you've ever received?
Hi, my name is Bonnie from Haddonfield, New Jersey. And the best thank you I ever received was after I agreed to drive my daughter over to visit some friends. She turned around and said to me, thank you for adopting me. And that was amazing.
From Seattle, Washington. It was simple, really. A handwritten note from my boss thanking me for specific things I did that contributed to the team's success that year. She finished by saying that her success would not have been possible without me. No money, no gifts, just a very sincere and specific acknowledgement of my work and its impact. Gold. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to give us some thank you pointers. We begin, though, with the practical realities that the Thanksgiving meal is, you have to admit, the hardest home-cooked meal of them all. Bigger, with more at stake, more people depending on you, where the enemy is relentless, time, ingredients, lumpy gravy. It's a hazing worthy of a Navy SEAL team.
2 minutes, you don't make it, you do it again.
Have you been tested this hard ever in your life?
Never.
Flour. Whole wheat flour.
Winning here is a conscious decision.
You will not fear a turkey neck.
You just prove to your bodies, through your mind.
Wash that lettuce.
That you can push yourself further than you thought possible.
Go. Pickles, carrots.
Go get wet. Run!
Asparagus does not cook itself.
You sure you want to be here?
Yes, I do.
Are you absolutely sure?
I'm positive.
Home cooking is no picnic, and some of you lone survivors out there shared your challenges doing it any day of the week or year.
Hi, this is Andrew from Honolulu, Hawaii. In our house, the term home-cooked no longer really means what it used to mean. We are really just heating up pre-cooked foods that we bought at the store. It's nothing like when we were kids and Mom would cook home-cooked meals. Oh, well.
Hi, this is Lisa from South Carolina. And a home-cooked meal is a luxury we can't afford. Our crazy schedule doesn't allow for it, and when I do cook, the kids think that my cooking does not taste as good as the fast food that they're used to getting.
Well, a team of sociologists at North Carolina State University is sympathetic to some of your concerns here, studied hundreds of low- and middle-income families trying to cook meals from scratch, and found that they experienced significant stress, didn't save money, and faced impossible schedules juggling work and kids. It's a conversation we had earlier this year with Sarah Bowen, a researcher on the study and an associate professor of sociology at North Carolina State University.
Well, we did find that the majority of the families that we interviewed were cooking most nights per week. On average, they were cooking 5 nights a week, and a lot of families were cooking more, either because they couldn't afford to eat out or because they felt it was important to be able to eat at home. But it was almost impossible for the poor families to enact this ideal of what an ideal home-cooked meal is for different reasons, because of money and time and other obstacles. And for the middle-class families, they were spending a lot of time reading literature on the best foods and trading recipes and cooking these meals, but they were also, they felt stressed and frustrated about not living up to the ideal of the ideal home-cooked meal.
How did that stress express itself in your research?
Well, for the middle-class moms who were the ones that were, you know, they had read all of these messages that we need to cook at home and that's the way we're going to have healthy kids and healthy families by making everything from scratch. So they were really trying hard to do this, but most of them worked and they often did have a partner at home to help them, but still everybody's getting home at 6 and they're scrambling to get dinner on the table while the kids run around. And all of the families we interviewed also did have young children, which I think is important. It was difficult.
Did you think that for the sample group, in many cases, the ideal of a home-cooked meal was really outmoded, was maybe not worth its apparent value?
Well, I think for a lot of the moms that we talked to, you know, a lot of them talked about how they liked cooking in theory. They liked caring for their family in that way, and they liked being creative in the kitchen. But in the article, we talk about a lot of the things that got in the way of how that worked day in and day out. So it was worth it to them to cook for their families, but because of money and time and also the stress of pleasing others, multiple family members and not everyone being home at the same time, this sometimes got in the way of what we think of when we think of what dinner at home should look like.
Sarah Bowen, I'm surprised that the dads weren't helping more in this day and age. It seems like moms were doing most of the work in your study.
In our study, the moms were doing the majority of the cooking work. There were a lot of families where the dads did help. But if you look at national time use studies, men do cook a lot more than they did in the 60s. But women still do more of the cooking work. So one of the things that we emphasize in our paper is that although men are an important part of this, women still do a lot of the cooking work. So sometimes when we tell people, you know, we need to cook more, that burden can disproportionately be placed on women, even unintentionally.
It sounds like there is a lot of work that can be done to help families trying to accomplish this.
We think so. We think that sharing the work of cooking is part of it. And another part of it is addressing some of these broader inequalities that underlie this. So the poor families really had, it was very difficult for them to meet the ideal because they worked non-standard work schedules, because they had, you know, they had to work 2 jobs to be able to stay afloat. And so part of making it possible for everyone to get these home-cooked meals involves dealing with things like wages and work schedules and food environments, making sure people have access to stores where they can shop that are relatively close by, so that everyone has the option of being able to enjoy food with their families.
Well, here's wishing you and your family a stress-free home-cooked meal this evening.
Thank you.
Sarah Bowen is Associate Professor of Sociology at North Carolina State University. Thanksgiving is a time for family.
We try to instill in them a sense of self-worth, of self-responsibility, respect for others, and love of mankind.
Sanchita Toni Tyson is a mom we celebrated on Mother's Day back in May of this year. Toni Tyson and her husband realized early on that they had their work cut out for them with 3 talented children growing up in the Bronx. Their oldest son was an artist. Their youngest had a talent for business and psychology. She would become a finance wizard in the energy industry. Their middle son was interested in the universe, all of it. Starting to get the picture? That middle child would become the science celebrity supernova astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Toni Tyson talked with us about the challenges of raising 3 black children in the Bronx in the 1960s. She wanted her kids tough but not angry over things like the time Neil brought a telescope into a public park one night and the police stopped him, thinking it was a weapon. Discouragement and anger, says Toni Tyson, were not options in her house.
It was not easy. It was a full-time, 24-hour-a-day job. All three of my children are brown, and they stay brown all year round, and they can even get darker in the summertime. And we had to make it very, very clear to them at a very early age that people, some people are not going to be very nice to them, but it was not their problem. It was the person's problem. And as a result, when things did occur, we would get onto it immediately. For instance, there was a situation when Neil was in junior high school, and I read about a scholarship that was available by the Department of Education, federal. And I got the application, and Neil filled it out, and he did the essay, and he had to get three references. And there was one teacher that he listed. I said, I don't think that's a good idea. Don't use him. He says, oh, why, Mom? He's great. He's a wonderful teacher. I said, that has nothing to do with it. I don't think you should use it. Use him. To make a long story short, he did. And you know what he was told when he presented it to the teacher? He said, what makes you think you can get this scholarship? Because he came home devastated. And as a result, he used another teacher. I got vibes from this individual that I did not like during one of the Parent Teachers Association.
And the what makes you think question was because he was black.
Of course. Of course. Either that or he didn't think he could do it intellectually or scholastically. That was one incident. And then there's several others. This whole business with the telescope going into Van Cortlandt Park, I often wondered whether if they had been white, whether the police would have stopped them. Just small incidences like that. So it was a constant vigilance. During the when he was applying for colleges, I indicated to him that we were, for all three of our children, that we were going to be their counselors, that we were going to review their college applications, and we will discuss their colleges with them and then take it to the guidance counselor at the schools, because I was afraid they were going to be deterred in some of their quests. And in Neil's case, he applied to various schools, and people wanted to know what his safety school was. Safety school was one of the Ivies. And they laughed at that. I said, don't pay any attention. Just send out the applications, okay? This was the time of affirmative action, and I think that people were afraid that Neil was going to get preferential treatment at the time. Everything worked out well, but these are little things, little nitty-gritty things that we constantly had to be on the alert about.
But they can stick with you.
Oh, of course they can.
And his success is so overwhelming. Went to Harvard, Columbia, PhD. Now is, you know, runs the Hayden Planetarium that he used to go to as a boy.
Right.
But there's not any sense in that success mm-hmm. that it's a there, I showed you.
No, no.
Why?
Oh, no,
why?
No.
You
no.
gave that to him.
No. We told it very good. Listen, we had to be grateful for what we have. This could have turned out anyway. It could have gone in any direction, okay? And we tried to instill in them a sense of self-worth, of self-responsibility, respect for others, and love of mankind. I mean, we're all here. This is a journey we're all taking together. So we just be nice to each other and love and be kind to people. And let's just carry it through, and all three of my kids have it.
More from Toni Tyson, mother of Neil deGrasse Tyson, right after the break. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, isn't there always someone at the Thanksgiving table who talks a little louder than all the rest?
Just look at the history of everybody doing big projects, and it's never driven by exploration. It's never driven by science. It's never driven by curiosity. Not if it's big and expensive. It's driven by the fact that people don't want to die.
That's astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's a little like an exploding star with a big smile on his face. He's star of the new Cosmos series. He's an evangelist for science in the tradition of Carl Sagan. How did he get this way? Big, brash, funny, full of energy, with quirks like his strange ties and colorful vests, as well as all those quarks. Well, for Mother's Day, we put that question of the origins of Neil deGrasse Tyson to his charming, unstoppable mom, Toni Tyson, who with her husband raised Neil and two other kids in New York City.
I personally think being an urban mom and being in an environment where everything was available as an educational tool, we use New York City as a lab for our three growing children. One was interested in art, the other in horseback riding, wanted to be a veterinarian, and Neil wanted to be an astrophysicist. I had no idea what an astrophysicist did. And when he originally told us that, I said, oh, that's very nice. I didn't know what it was. I had to look it up. Okay, and then when I finally found out, we went on a trail. We said, let's see where this will take us in terms of what opportunities are available here in within the five boroughs. And we took advantage of the American Museum of Natural History, the planetarium. That was his second home. He took classes at the Hayden Planetarium, and he was sometime the youngest child in the class. It was all very exciting. We enjoyed it very much. It was a wonderful time bringing them up in New York City.
And now he's, you know, roaming the galaxy on Fox television. Jeez.
I know, in his spaceship, all of these ordinary, hardworking Americans who can sit in front of their television and be exposed to pure science. I think that's really wonderful.
Do you think it's a vision that your son had to do something like that, to carry on Carl Sagan's vision?
Well, he was absolutely, absolutely amazed when Carl Sagan invited him up to Cornell. I mean, he was in a state of shock. There's no two ways about it. And he was so thrilled. And, of course, Cosmos was done before that. And then when Annie approached him about it, he was just, again, thrilled at the concept of being able to do this again.
You know, he's such an expert on so many things. But for him, what are you an expert about?
People.
Really?
Yeah. You have a certain perception that you look at people and you see the interaction and the subtleties involved. And I think my generation has it, because my generation went through the Depression. We had hard times. You know, we grew up in a poor city, and we had to be perceptive in order to, the name of the game was survival.
Civil rights era?
Absolutely. School strikes. I would walk the picket line with them.
You got to size people up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And during that horrible New York City public school strike, all three of them were in different they were all in public school, elementary, junior, and senior. And I went across the picket line. I think it was with Neil we went through. And some of the parents were already in the building, and the police tried to stop us. And I just told Neil, just hold my hand. Don't say a word. Just follow me. But that was a very, very uncomfortable experience.
Well, I wonder if we could, drag your son away from his public for a couple of seconds to just wish you a happy Mother's
Day. I
don't
know. Let's see. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, what have we here?
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello, corazón. How are you? Do you know that I am presently on the air?
You are.
And I understand that you are supposed to give me Mother's Day greetings, even though I'll see you on Sunday.
Yeah, I told him that. I said, I'm not going to make it look like I'm not seeing you on Mother's Day.
Oh, you better do that. That's out of the question, Bubby. Because I've always told you and your brother and sister, every day is a Mother's Day.
And
Grandmother's Day, too.
Yeah, I mean, every day should be a lot of days.
Neil, she says the best gift, maybe the best gift she has given you down the years, and there's certainly many, but one she really mentioned in this conversation was her insights about people.
Well, I attribute, I would say, 80% of my socialization to being raised by my two parents. This upbringing grounded me in the reality of life. And it wasn't just, can you have a conversation with someone? But I would say more important than all of that is, can you understand how other people suffer in this world? And is there anything you can do about it? Is there any way you can devote some of your life's energy to remedy that? And I'm now quoted. I must have been an AMA session on Reddit, where someone asks me what drives me, and one of the three things that I listed that drives me every day is to every day you should try to lessen the suffering of others, at least a little bit. Just it doesn't matter what. Just helping someone across the street, giving someone directions, bringing food to someone, and I got this entirely from my parents. There was never a day of my life where I wasn't exposed to this. And I would say that's a fundamental part of who I am as a person and even as a professional.
Neil, you keep this up, I'm going to be crying all over the microphone.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we don't want her to cry, but I do have something that I do need to ask the two of you about, okay?
Go for it.
Tony, can you help me to understand the really crazy ties your son wears?
It's showbiz. It's showbiz.
No, I would wear them. No, let me correct that. I would wear them even if no one was looking. And if you go to any astronomy conference where you never heard of half the people there, everybody's wearing a geeky astronomy tie. It's just our little way of wearing our profession, not on our sleeve, but on our chest. And so now, if you want to psychoanalyze that, go ahead.
Well, no, it's a philosophical question. If a geeky astronomy tie falls in the forest, is it still Neil deGrasse Tyson?
I would find it. I would feel the vibe. I'd feel the energy field that would radiate, and I'd be, because even of all my geek friends, I probably own more geeky ties than they do. I have probably more than 100.
All right. Well, we're gonna let you go, Neil. But please, if you would be so kind, just wish your spectacular mom a happy Mother's Day before we go.
Mom, happy Mother's Day, and you know we're all gonna be together. So. But I don't mind wishing it twice. Happy Mother's Day.
Okay, Corazon. You don't have to wear your tie.
Okay. I'll leave it at home.
Okay.
Sure. All right.
See you then.
All right, guys.
Bye. Thanks
Take
for
care.
Calling.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
thank
that
you
was a
so
surprise.
Much.
Well, you're quite welcome.
And thanks for, you know, improving the cosmos.
I'm delighted.
Toni Tyson, mother of Neil deGrasse Tyson. Come with us now and dream along with Kristen Meinzer and actor Jason Schwartzman. But please don't cut your fingers if you're slicing onions right now. We can enter this imaginary radio world moment as long as you promise to be careful.
Is that the sound of your dreams?
Yeah. This is it.
You're dreaming about walking through a forest.
And the forest is made of...
They look like sea monsters, but they're actually magical leaves.
And they're referred to as...
Pumpkin men.
By the local...
People who carry pitchforks.
And then I woke up.
When he did finally wake up, and that improvised dream sequence ran for more than 3 minutes, he got down to the business of talking about his new movie, Listen Up, Philip, where he plays an abrasive, self-loathing novelist who berates a student who comes into his office to just ask for a letter of recommendation.
Look, I'll say this and then we can proceed accordingly. Number one, internships are a waste of time, so you shouldn't bother. Two, that company sucks and you wouldn't gain any worthwhile experience there. And three, I don't actually think that I know you very well. Or at all, now that I think about it. So I wouldn't be the best person to sing your praises. Where does that leave us on the whole letter of recommendation tip?
I think they can be somewhat generic. It's kind of a formality anyway.
Nah.
No pumpkin monsters here, just snarky Jason in a tortured relationship with his girlfriend, played by Elizabeth Moss.
I think it's funny because most movies, so much of it is like the journey of someone trying to find themselves or learn something. But this guy basically, or at least thinks he's pretty positive he knows who he is and doesn't care to learn anything. Because he knows everything, he thinks. And that was fun to do.
You haven't ever played anyone this awful before.
Mm-mm.
And a lot of people probably know you best for all your Wes Anderson roles,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like Fantastic Mr. Fox, Grand Budapest Hotel, Rushmore, obviously. How is working with Wes Anderson from your very first movie, Rushmore, mm-hmm. on, how has that shaped you and how you act?
Well, completely shaped me, completely. Before I met Wes, I wasn't acting. I was just, you know, a guy in high school in a band, and he gave me my first role and changed my life, and I started to become an actor. He's so funny to me that it can't help but shape who I am.
Well, I have a dream, and I don't know if this dream will ever come true, but I would love it. I have a dream that you're actually going to be a big musical star at some point where
really?
You're going to have a bunch of musicals that come out. Have you
wow.
ever thought about that?
My mom has always said, you should, because my mom is like a musical person. I mean, she just, and growing up, we just listened to musicals all the time and watched musicals. And she has I'll brag on her behalf, like an almost encyclopedic musical database in her brain. And she can just sing so many pieces of music. I don't see myself doing one in that way because I never like sang, and I just, it's not something I feel very comfortable doing. I sing on the records, but you know, it's like you double track your voice. There's no one watching you. You can take your time. You can be off. A musical, like, remember they did when they did Les Mis, the Oscars. Yeah, and,
yeah.
They, and they sang at the Oscars live. I was watching it going like, oh my God, this is incredible. I mean, it's incredible to be able to do that. And that's something I wish I could do that.
I believe in you.
Well, I thank you so much. Maybe there's like a perfect musical we could find. It's like about someone who's afraid to do a musical.
Oh, it's going to be a groundbreaker.
Oh, good. I'm happy to break ground.
Jason Schwartzman, thank you so much for joining
us today.
Thank
you. This is so fun.
It was so fun.
I appreciate it.
Jason Schwartzman is the star of the new movie Listen Up, Philip, and you can go to our website at thetakeaway.org to hear the complete dream sequence, Jason, Kristen, and the Pumpkin People. One of our favorite moments recently was a conversation about something you may be slicing right now or dreaming about in pies about to go into the oven, or that pie sitting there on the back seat of your car on your way to your mom's house. Apples. Through our partner, the New York Times, we met Dan Bussey, who in 1983 went from restaurant supply salesman to become the James Audubon of apples. He started a little apple orchard, fell in love with the palm, and began cataloging every apple variety he could find, and some you can't find anymore. That's 17,000 varieties grown between 1623 and 2000 in North America, all to be found in Dan Bussey's comprehensive catalog, his personal homage to the tasty, shiny, healthy, and sometimes we learn maybe a little homely apple.
What got me started was back in 1979, I read a book called Apples and Man by Fred Lape. And it talked about all the old varieties of apples that had existed. It really talked about the lexicon of apples, the names that they had. And I got really fascinated with the names. And the more I tried to find out, the more I realized I didn't know where to look. I had no idea where to find information about these old varieties. And so it, as just an intellectual curiosity for my own self, I started collecting little tidbits wherever I could find them.
The folk tale about apples in the United States comes from the old Johnny Appleseed, who spread apples around, and I don't even know what varieties he was spreading, but apples are certainly a global phenomenon. And can you give us a sense of the taxonomy and biology of apples?
Sure. The apple as we know it, the Malus domestica, is basically descended from the Malus subversii, which was from Kazakhstan, that part of Western China and very far Eastern Europe. There has been some intermingling, of course, with the Malus sylvestris, which is the European wild crab. And so all that genetics has come over here. And so we have the cider varieties and we have all the really great eating apples and all that influence that those genes have put into apples.
So what is the range of flavors? The Red Delicious, of course, is very sweet, almost too sweet for my taste. The Granny Smiths are quite sour. The Macones and the McIntoshes have that sort of classic fall apple taste.
Yeah.
But there's lots in between the colors of the rainbow, as you understand it. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah, some have a sort of a singularly clear, sweet flavor, and then they'll go to the point of being almost nutty, very complex flavors. Many of the russet varieties have very rich, full flavors that have such nice sugar-acid balances to it. They're spectacular.
One thing I learned from reading about you is that shape is by no means an indicator of flavor.
No, it doesn't mean anything at all. You can have an apple that is almost unattractive. I guess I hate to say that when it comes to an apple, but there are those that do not have much for looks, and they can have absolutely spectacular flavor. They can be tiny, they can be huge, anything in between. So no, we need to not eat with our eyes and look behind the skin and see what's there, and that's where the joy is.
If there was an apple that you could go back in time and grab off a shelf or pull off a tree and sit on a fall day and just let the juices drip down your face, what would it be?
Well, I thought about that apple a little bit, and the one that I came up with, and it's one I have found, is a variety called Perkins. That was my grandfather's favorite apple. And I always wanted to know what it was that attracted him to it. And so I actually put a reward notice out in a paper, and I got one call, and a person had it. And it's a lovely apple.
Well, happy apple season. And can you give us a guide, a sense of what's the best taste in a cider if we're looking for one? There's so much that claims to be, you know, fresh off the presses. Of course, it all has to be, you know, pasteurized nowadays. It's really, really difficult to find unpasteurized cider anymore. Is there anything you particularly look for when you're looking for fresh cider?
Well, find that orchard that has a nice, diverse group of varieties. Find the late-season cider. Those are the apples that are harvested just before it freezes up. They will have the best developed sense of sugars and acid balance, and by far, they're the most superior.
Dan Butsey, that is great advice, and happy apple season to you.
Blessings to you, too.
Go red. That's right. Start up your crimson Ferrari on the street and watch the heads turn. It takes a certain personality and a certain bank account to want to gather a crowd around a cloud of red that says, hey, look, a red Ferrari is equal parts masculine swagger and feminine curves. All for the tidy sum of $270,000. But you don't have to spend even close to that to get the same head turns on the street. For $20, one hot red lipstick will get you all the curves and standout horsepower you need on a summer day. Heck, author Madeline Marsh has the confidence to take on a Ferrari in a one-on-one street fight. The author of Compact and Cosmetic says strong women have been winning street battles with the color red on their lips for a lot longer than Ferraris have been around.
Red lipstick is, in fact, about female strength. Lipstick came in the 20th century, and the first and most famous manifestation of red lipstick was in fact in New York, when the suffragettes took to the streets, banded together, and as part of their defiance and their fight for the vote, they all wore bright red lipstick. And, you know, again, looking through history, you can see that during the war in Britain, I mean, cosmetics were certainly hard to come across because we were making more important things. But the lipstick that was being made was given names like Fighting Red, Patriot Red, Grenadier Red. And ladies were encouraged to look your best, to do your best. So, you know, on the one hand, lipstick is always portrayed as being about sexuality. But that strong vein and the power of women and the power of presenting yourself in a sort of a strong way is always there, too.
And I don't know, you know, where that history comes from, but it's alive and well in my house. I've got three daughters, and my soft-spoken, maybe slightly reserved, I wouldn't call her shy exactly, daughter, she wears kind of skin-colored lipstick. But my other two daughters, who, you know, are kind of like, you know, fighter pilots of feminism, red lipstick all the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always very much been about strength. In the 1970s, lipstick went out, you know, along with shaving your legs and whatnot, and part of the feminist revolution was not wearing makeup, and makeup and cosmetics, lipstick, shaving, they were all portrayed very much as sort of patriarchal oppression. But if you think of Rosie the Riveter, I mean, there she is, this big butch lady in her overalls with arms like prize-winning hams, yet she's got hennaed hair, red nail varnish and bright red lipstick. So, you know, you can be a lipstick feminist quite happily. But what do you feel about red lipstick on a woman?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's absolutely great. I mean, I do wonder, that must require a lot of maintenance because, you know, it does tend to fade as time goes on, and you know it's hard to keep that, you know,
yeah,
that Ferrari absolutely red look, you know, that you want. But you know, I am amazed at how quickly and stealthily women can kind of, you know, redo the paint job there.
Oh, well, one of my favorite sights is on the tube in the morning in London. When you see girls doing this full makeup, like everything, so they come in, you know, barefaced, and by the time they've gone five stops, they've done the whole thing. And what, you know, what's interesting about lipstick and about makeup was that, you know, initially Yeah, I didn't say in the very early 20th century, it was regarded as, you know, terrible. You had to be a prostitute or an actress if you were painting your face. But when cosmetics and lipsticks became acceptable, which was after World War One, suddenly what came with them, and in fact invented by you, well, not you personally, obviously, but I'm taking you as a representative of your nation, invented by the Americans, was the portable, the metal lipstick tube with the push-up lever and the swiveling lipstick. And once you could, you know, put these things, once they were safely packaged, no stopping them. And it became acceptable to put your makeup on in public. But, you know, not everybody liked it. And a great opponent of this was Coco Chanel, who, in fact, thought that red lipstick and red nail varnish were both exquisitely vulgar, hated the fact that ladies, when they came to her house, would leave their little cosmetic cases on the table. It's very vulgar. How can they do that? And was furious. She says, as the red lipstick, it marked my glasses and my table linen. If they come like that, I give them paper serviettes.
And if you look at the old, you know, ads in newspapers and magazines, I mean, it's really a throwback to the 1700s without all of the heavy rigging. You know what I mean?
It's, well, that ads are fascinating because the, I know, you know, cosmetics and lipstick, it can seem like a quite a trivial subject, ooey, very girly. But in fact, it's about much more than that because it shows us what we expect women to be at particular periods. You know, like, say, the war thing, when, you know, having your lipstick on was part of your fight against the enemy. And actually, while we're on the topic of war, Hitler hated lipstick, said it was made from animal fat rescued from sewage. The Aryan ideal was a pure, unscrubbed face, and visitors to Hitler's sort of country retreat, they were actually given, lady visitors were given a little list of things they must not do, avoid excessive cosmetics, avoid red lipstick, and on no account ever to colour their nails.
So I know you're married now, and
I am.
I don't want to you know, create any problems here. Of course he is. But can you give me a case of where you know that your evening, your date, your romantic encounter really hinged upon the lipstick and that that was the thing that was working for you?
Do you want to know what? No, because I think men don't really notice a lot of the time, and I think the people who notice are women. And I really think it's about how we feel about ourselves. And I look back over the list of my husbands and boyfriends, and I don't think any of them really give a monkey's, quite frankly. I think it's about how you feel about yourself, and that makes you attractive.
Wisdom for the ages from Madeline Marsh, the author of Compact and Cosmetics. Thanks so much.
Thank you indeed.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
And finally on this Thanksgiving Day, a little something to listen to. An album all about family, love, and serious dedication.
Open it up. I call that the Beatles Black Album. Best of John, Paul, George, and Ringo, solo, post-breakup.
Thanks. Yeah, basically I put the band back together for you. You know, when you ever listen to too much of the solo stuff, it kind of becomes a drag, you know?
But you put them next to each other, and they start to elevate each other. It's the Beatles.
If you saw the amazing movie Boyhood, you know this moment where Ethan Hawke gives his son in the movie a music mix he calls the Black Album. A dad trying to impart wisdom to his child plays old-school FM DJ in three CDs worth of music.
Top of Volume 2, first four tracks. You got Band on the Run, Into My Sweet Lord, Into Jealous Guy, Into Photograph. Come on! It's like the perfect segue. You got Paul takes you to the party. George talks to you about God.
John, who says, no, it's about love and pain. And then Ringo, who just says, hey, can we enjoy what we have while we have it?
Well, the rain exploded with a mighty crash as we fell into the sun. Really want to see you, Lord, but it takes so long, my Lord. My sweet Lord, I didn't mean to hurt you. I'm sorry that I made you cry.
Lesson here? That each individual Beatles work, carefully and meticulously collected and organized, magically reveals the creative power of collaboration and the miraculous synergy of the original Fab Four. Actor Ethan Hawke actually did this in real life for his daughter, and director Richard Linklater made it part of the movie Boyhood, which got good reviews on this show some weeks back. Today we review the Black Album with our own old-school FM DJ John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC.
The idea is that the Beatles were more than the sum of their parts, and that apart, they are somewhat less than themselves. And that by putting them together this way, by juxtaposing the best of their individual songs, they buttress each other and they complement each other, even as they sometimes contrast with each other. There's a good example in the second of the three CDs where you hear John Lennon, a kind of a deep cut from him,
right,
called Crippled Inside, which
right
has a very kind of gut bucket American sound to it. That is adjacent to Ringo Starr's You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine, a song that I've always thought was in questionable taste. But here, next to this kind of John Lennon song, the kind of American roots feel of the Ringo song comes out in a way that I had never experienced
before.
So
first the deep cut, and then the much more familiar Ringo tune. These pairings are great. What's another one?
Well, you know, there are a number of there's a moment where he brings Paul McCartney's Pipes of Peace and John Lennon's Imagine together. You know, two songs about love and peace. Mull of Kintyre by Paul McCartney is right next to John Lennon's O Yoko. Both songs have a kind of folk song quality to them. Again, something that in the John Lennon case isn't really obvious until you put it next to Mull of Kintyre, which sounds like an old Scottish folk song or something like that.
Part of this is kind of an old radio thing in the sense that DJs love to talk
exactly
about their segues. And
yes,
I can see it right on your face.
This is exactly what this – this is not just a mixtape.
Right.
This is an old school, free form, late night FM college DJ.
There you go.
Putting together the most awesome set of songs that he or she can imagine. I have a few quibbles. You know, Ethan Hawke says to his son's character in the film that this is the best of the four of them post-Beatles. Where is 1985 by Paul McCartney?
Mm-hmm.
Where is Whatever Gets You Through the Night by John Lennon?
Gotcha.
Where's Living in the Material World by George? There are a couple of things I really wish were in here. But by the end, the beauty of his concept becomes apparent at the final CD, the end of the third of the three CDs, in this really extraordinary moment where you have Paul McCartney's Here Today, his song mm-hmm about his love and relationship for John after he'd been killed, juxtaposed with George Harrison's All Things Must Pass.
And if I say I really loved you and was glad you came along, then you were here today. Ooh, for you were in my song. All things must pass. All things must pass away.
All things must pass following here today from Paul McCartney, that would be a real great, weepy place to leave us. But he doesn't leave us there. There's a little musical coda, which is Paul McCartney in an MTV Unplugged show doing a version of And I Love Her, as if to say, after everything, after the bitterness, after the strife, after all of that, something endures, and it's the music, and it's a great old Beatles classic that endures. It's not the Beatles playing it, and it's a slightly different tempo and a slightly different rhythm, but it is that great old Beatles tune, and it's as if Ethan Hawke is saying, something of the Beatles survives the four of them.
A love like ours.
The hope is that in the larger context of what he's talking about, of love and regret and guilt and remorse and all of that, that something endures from that process as well.
It's a beautiful acoustic song, and it's a great coda. And as Ethan Hawke says to his son, you are the music of whatever happened in our relationship, referring to his own marriage.
Mm-hmm. And let's also remember, he calls this the Black Album. It's the counterpart to the White Album, which is the sound of a band falling apart. And the Black Album, in a sense, is the sound of one man putting that band back together in his imagination and now in our ears.
If we yearned for the Beatles to get back together, does the Black Album deliver that?
Oh, that's a big question. I would say no, because I think at the end of the day, that is in fact not the intent of the Black Album. The intent is exactly what the fictional character is saying in the Linkletter film, because this was something that Ethan Hawke did in real life for his daughter. So this is very much about family and about the passing of time and about the passing of your love of music, of your family, or whatever, onto your children and to the rest of your family. And that, on that level, it works.
John Schaefer, thanks so much.
John, thank you.
John Schaefer is the host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC. To see the full list of tracks on the Black Album, go to our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. From our family here at The Takeaway to yours, have a happy Thanksgiving. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.